Blog Talk Radio.
Delving past the headlines, sorting through the media bias, exposing the propaganda, and challenging you to use your brain. It's time to tap into the truth.
Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed time to tap into the truth. Welcome to today's broadcast. Hope you are having a great day wherever you are and whatever you may be doing. With you, as always, this is your host, Tim Tapp, coming to you live from historic Roane County, Tennessee. And we are waiting to hear from our first hour guest today, that being Mr. Danny Page. We will try to make contact with him here briefly, as I'm actually trying to overcome a technical glitch that I can't seem to get rid of. At any rate, there we go. I seem to have it now, at least I think so. Anyway, welcome. Those of you who are regular listeners know it has been a while since I have broadcasted right here on Blog Talk. I have been doing a bit here and there on Spreaker, but I've taken an extended leave since the death of my father. But the bottom line is there's just way too many things going on right now for us not to be in the fray and having the conversation. One of those things is simply a matter of our elections. And speaking of elections, our guest is with us now. Danny, how are you today?
I'm very well, Tim. How are you?
Doing very well, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your campaign to be with us. You have, of course, been on the show a few times before, actually made the announcement that you would be running as an independent here on the show. I like to think of you as a friend of the show, and definitely wanted to give you an opportunity, first of all, to, well, tell us what your impressions of the Republican primary race were, since you initially were considering running as a Republican.
Okay, well, thank you for letting me come back on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and your audience. You guys have been a friend to us, so I appreciate that. Republican primary, I will say this up front. I was not surprised that Lamar won, but I was surprised at how well Joe Carr did, and I want to compliment him, compliment his campaign, all the people that pulled that together, that work hard, and the passion that goes in that, because I live that every day, so I understand. So I want to congratulate him. It was not a loss in that sense. To pull 40% against Lamar Alexander with five and six other people in the race, that was really a victory in that sense. But at the end of the day, we're still left with the need to unseat Lamar Alexander. And so we foresaw that with the six candidates vying all for the same votes, and we pulled out and decided to run as an independent. And so, you know, we got about 80 days left of the general election, Tim, and we need to come together now. We need to get this done.
Speaking of coming together and the fact that there were six and even now about six different people that were running against Lamar, you have now got the support of several of those folks that were running against Lamar that early on in the early stages of this campaign were actually rivals of yours. These same people that you were going around and talking to, that they were trying to get your votes. Tell us a little bit about how that support's come about and where that's standing.
Yeah, this week we spent a couple of days up in Knoxville in East Tennessee, and three of the candidates that ran in the GOP primary are in East Tennessee, two of them in Knoxville specifically. And, you know, votes are votes. And they may have pulled 5-6% between the three of them, those are several thousand votes, and we're talking 10% difference in beating Lamar on August 7th. Plus, you have to consider how many Democrats came out and voted for Lamar in that primary. So those 6%, that's a big number in that regard. So Aaron McGee, Brenda Leonard, which I know you have Brenda on your show, and John Dean have come out in support of our campaign. Brenda and John have agreed to help rally, go out and speak as surrogates for us, and try to bring all their voters, all their supporters into one corral and get this done, because there's a credibility issue on the line here, Tim. There's an integrity issue. If on August 7th, primary election day, it was this expedient that we beat Lamar Alexander, that doesn't change today. Going into the November 4th general election, we still have to beat Lamar Alexander. If he was bad on August 7th, he's bad today. And those three individuals signed on very quickly. I will say this. I have calls into Dr. George Flynn and his campaign. Some of his supporters have already come on with us, but I need the doc to come out and to make that public endorsement, that public statement. You know, we've met, and he says he likes me and all that good stuff. But, you know, we got to get it done at this point. I'm reaching out to Christian Agnew. I actually went by his house because he doesn't live far from me, but he had a house fire, so I'm not sure what happened there or where he's at. Haven't been able to reach him yet. He was 2 or 3% of the vote. And, of course, the big one is Joe Carr. And lots of Joe Carr people have automatically translated our way, and we need to come together. Like I said, if Lamar Alexander is a bad senator for the state of Tennessee, then he's a bad senator for the state of Tennessee, and there was more votes cast against him than cast for him, we need to get this done. And if you're a Joe Carr supporter in the primary, I challenge you to go to my website to look it over. I challenge you to call me, to email me, to ask me the questions. I believe you'll find that you can easily be a supporter of mine. But I need you to put pressure on Joe Carr, pressure on the Beat Lamar team. Hey, guys, you pumped this into us for a year that Lamar Alexander was bad. Don't abandon us now. Stand up and be leaders and say, go vote for Danny Page.
All right. There's no question. If Tennessee was like a lot of other states out there that actually had runoffs in their primary races, the Republican primary would still be underway. The very fact that there was, in fact, so much support for Joe Carr led to a lot of people trying to convince him into having a write-in campaign. He came out, he announced, of course, that he wasn't going to do that, but he took a little time. He thought about it. And, you know, to me that signifies two things. Number one, that he was serious about trying to lead via conservative values. And number two, he saw that there was really the real possibility, the real chance that maybe had Democratic voters not crossed over, that he should have won that primary. It would be really nice if he would now recognize you as a remaining conservative voice, even though you are an independent, you're not going to have the big money behind you. It'd be nice if that support did come your way. So, yeah, I'm also going to go ahead and make a call out to all Joe Carr supporters. Take a serious look at Danny. The man is, well, the man is everything that he says he is. He's an honest-to-goodness, hardworking individual. He understands what it means to live on a budget, and he does everything that he can to take care of his family. And so these things are important. He understands traditional Christian family values, and there's no question we need more of that in D.C. While we're on a similar topic, seems like Mr. Alexander has had some issues with campaigning laws. Can you tell us a little bit about how that is proceeding?
Well, that's proceeding as we figured it was. And for your audience, if they're not aware, we filed a Federal Elections Commission complaint against Lamar Alexander, a State Ethics Committee complaint. And there was one other complaint that we filed against him, all because he colluded with the Tennessee State Museum to run a museum attraction coinciding with his reelection campaign. It made the news last summer, but no one ever filed a complaint. The election commission didn't do anything. He had earmarked $400,000 for this state museum. You know, a whole lot of money changing hands. And, you know, it was just going to be a victory lap for him. And the museum was going to go around and do all the stops where he had walked across the state. It was going to be a traveling exhibit. And the lady that runs the museum was a Lamar Alexander appointee from when he was governor. And, you know, she was quick to say, hey, we didn't even realize he was running for reelection. But, you know, we have the emails through public disclosure laws where her museum was emailing his reelection team, not his Senate office, but his reelection office. So, you know, that boat don't float. So they knew good and well he was running for reelection. So, of course, they postponed the exhibit till after. But here's the thing. We knew it wasn't going to get any traction. In fact, right after I filed the FEC complaint, the FEC came to me and said, hey, you haven't filed your disclosure statement. And so I had to prove to them that I had filed my financial disclosure statement. So he was trying to play, you know, tit for tat. Yeah. And Lamar has the power to do that. You know, I imagine I'll get audited by the IRS this year, probably.
Well, I would say just about anybody that expresses a conservative slant over the next few years ought to be worried about that, given the targeting that the IRS has done. But, I just wanted to make sure that the listening audience was aware that not only did this happen, but that you're actually in the fight here. You're in the fray. You filed this. You've taken a stand, and you're on record.
Right.
There's no question. You know, I have talked in the past about Lamar Alexander's resume. He has done a lot of great things for the state of Tennessee. There's no question. But at the same time, he has always been a get-along-to-come-along kind of guy. He has had rather liberal ideas about education at the national level. And while all these things kind of coalesce into someone that doesn't really represent Tennessee values anymore, I think it's important for folks that are outside of the state that maybe don't understand how what looks like a lock in the Republican Party in a conservative state could still be such a contentious race. There's just this overwhelming thing that everyone needs to be aware of, and that is when we send people to D.C., we need to do so with the intent of only having them there so long. We send somebody to drain the cesspool, but they end up enjoying the party. And it's really only a matter of time before people just have a hard time turning down and moving away from all those temptations to kind of, well, maybe if I take just a little bit. It's really hard expectations. So with that in mind, I did have a couple of questions that were offered up from some of the listeners over at Tea Party Community.
Okay.
One of them specifically was asking if you would actively work to try and institute term limits for both the House and the Senate.
Absolutely, and I would be thrilled to author that bill. And that is one of the main things I find on the campaign trail. Personally, I am a term limits guy. I cannot stand the thought, really, of being in Washington because it is a cesspool. And just in this campaigning, the politics is one nasty business. But I'm a term limits guy, and I will author the bill. I will author the constitutional amendment. You know, it's just absolutely laughable that they slapped the constitutional amendment on the presidency, but excluded themselves.
And it's time for Congress to pay up. And I will do that for the state of Tennessee. And I find that on the campaign trail to be one of the first issues of talk. We want term limits.
All right, absolutely. Now, because you had been on the show before, and I had actually had that question with you before, I already was aware of that. But listeners always have to assume that somebody's new to the show.
Sure.
And, you know, that's absolutely fantastic. You are definitely a constitutionally limited government kind of guy. You have a great appeal to the same folks that Joe Carr was appealing to, and I think to a lot of other voters across the country. Same person also asked a question, and I'll go ahead and get it out of the way, because it really wasn't something I had intended on touching on today because of other things that are going on in the world that I wanted to get your take on. But they also wanted to know what you would be doing in regards and where you stood with GMO labeling and GMO in the standard food supply. I'm sure you probably heard this question more than a few times by now, but
that's a great question. And the sad thing is that most of the American public just aren't aware of what genetically modified organisms are. And if you listen to the spin that those that produce that, you know, it's sickening in and of itself. My family, we do a lot of food shopping up in what we call Amish country, just across the Kentucky border in Scottsville, Kentucky. So we get a lot of raw foods, a lot of whole foods. Now, granted, you know, when we're out eating at a restaurant, you never know quite what you're getting. But we try to watch labeling and stuff at stores and try to eat as organic as possible. I'm raising 6 kids, and I'm just not real sure what we're putting in their bodies anymore. And you know, it's not that I'm this crazy health nut, you know, in the perfect shape, because I, by far, I am not. I've got a sweet tooth, and I put stuff in my body that I probably shouldn't. But we're trying to be conscious of that. And I don't like government regulation, Tim, and labeling food products with GMO labels. That is government regulation, but that's something that people need to be aware of. When you take a gene out of a fish and you graft it into a tomato in order to make that tomato more resilient to wet weather, and I get that because I've raised tomatoes, and if you get too much rain, then it ruins your crop. But that ain't the way God designed it. he put the genes in the tomatoes that the tomatoes need. And what is that doing inside of our bodies? And quite frankly, I just don't trust what's going on. And the fact that they don't want it labeled just screams that there's a problem. They should gladly say, okay, label our product. The fact that they want to change the names of some of their products because people are catching on, you know, the high fructose corn syrup, getting off of the GMO just a little bit here, but, you know, it started getting the bad rap, so they want to change it to corn sugar.
That is absolutely straight out of the liberals' playbook for every time they're losing a political argument. If you can't win by telling the truth, you change the language so that it sounds much nicer.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Just rebrand.
So you would be, in fact, willing to either author a bill or co-sponsor a bill that would move towards forced labeling in the U.S. of GMO and possibly even an attempt to keep that outside of the mainstream food channel.
Right.
Just
wanted
to make sure we got that.
If you look at the world, the world is running away from GMOs. When you would think that they would be welcoming it, because you know the science behind the GMO is we can grow more corn, we can grow more of this, more of that in desert situations, in rainy situations, and in all kind of environments and atmospheres, we can grow it. We can feed the world. But the world where poverty is more and famine is more prevalent, they're running as far away from GMOs as they can because they see that America's eat up with cancer and they're not. And does GMOs cause cancer? I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. but there's something going on in America that just isn't really happening on that scale across the world. And Monsanto, they're the number one culprit in GMOs. You can grow a plot of corn on your land that's Monsanto corn, and I'm next door to you, and I've got heirloom corn, natural seeds. And then Monsanto says because of cross-pollination, they now own my crop. Where do we live at? I thought we lived in a free land. But, you know, the honeybees brought their product over to my land, and you know, Monsanto is being outlawed across the world. But yet we have put some of their leaders in charge of the FDA.
Okay.
And talk about
There are three things that cries that you definitely need to be paying attention to. Number one is the fact that we live in a country with the highest rate of obesity, but still one of the worst levels of nutrition. I mean, we have people that suffer from malnutrition, but we have an abundance to eat. We also have seen unprecedented new levels of food allergens. And, the cancer rate also has been skyrocketing. So these things point to the simple fact that there's something different about our food supply. The other thing is the fact that everybody that talks from the other side of the point of view here instantly wants to push this issue into the realm of the conspiracy theorist and the tinfoil hat crowd. If these people are instantly pointing it over there, it's time to take a closer look, because they're trying to discredit it immediately. And I think we've all seen by now that a lot of the folks that are deemed conspiracy theorists are just a little bit ahead of the curb. Also, the very simple fact that, like you pointed out, the rest of the world isn't just walking, they're running away from GMO foods. They don't want it in their food supply. They don't want contact with it. That's not coincidence, that's not accident, and that's not ignorance, no matter what anybody wants to say. Let's go ahead and we'll switch over. Lady Michelle was in the chat room, and she said that more important than term limits is the repeal of the 17th Amendment. Let's go ahead and get your take on that while we're being interactive.
Absolutely. The 17th Amendment, I've talked about this on your show before, that was the way our forefathers designed it. The U.S. Senate was designed to be a body that would protect states' rights, that would stand up for the 10th Amendment, and there would be watchdogs, watchmen, if you will, sitting on the wall and saying, no, that's not going to fly with the state of Tennessee, and we're not going to allow that. But what happened 100 years ago, progressives got in there, and they passed the 17th Amendment, and they basically made U.S. senators were, before they were appointed by the state houses, and they would appoint people that they knew, that they trusted, that would go out there and would serve the people, and then they become this elected body. Basically, they're a House of Representatives at large, if you will, and every state gets two of them, and they're elected by the majority of the people, and the states, we see it. The states are not being taken care of. All these lawsuits we've seen filed by the states in the past 5 or 6 years because of federal intrusion, whether it be Obamacare, whether it be immigration, or whatever it is, Lamar Alexander and Bob Corker, they're not looking out for the state of Tennessee, the sovereignty of Tennessee. Yes, I am a voice and a vote to repeal the 17th Amendment and to put it back into the hands. And you know what, Tim? If it was like that today, if the 17th Amendment did not exist, then I would not even be in the thought process of our state house. Hey, what about that Danny Page guy? He'd make a good U.S. senator. I wouldn't be on their radar screen at all. And so I realize I'd be putting myself out of an opportunity to serve. But I'm fine with that, because that was the intent of our forefathers, and those guys were inspired, and those guys were, you know, geniuses when it comes to this republic.
Agreed. I think the biggest argument here is sadly lost on the majority of Americans because they just don't understand even the simple concept of states' rights. They don't understand the Senate was created to represent the states' interests and, more importantly, the states' values, to be that voice for them, as opposed to just another version of your House of Representatives. A lot of folks don't get it. They don't understand it. They don't even want to look back at it, and they've been led to believe that somehow that's a move against them, and that's why they moved that way. But when you take a look at what Arizona and Texas in particular over the last several years of the Obama administration has had to do, not the least of which we'll touch on a little bit more, the current border crisis going on, it's absolutely unreal to think that we've come this far and the folks in Washington just want to keep going full speed ahead in the opposite direction, which is why it's even more important for us to elect people that are willing to stand up and do that. I mean, you said it yourself. You know that in essence you would be removing yourself from the equation if it was the way it was supposed to be. So that shows a level of understanding. Is there any other particular updates specifically to the campaign that you'd like to discuss before we move on to some of the world events that you as Senator Danny Page would have to face?
Well, let me point out and plug, if I will, DannyPage4Senate.com or Page4TN.com. Check out the website. There's all kind of articles, all kind of topics, platform and policy positions, some pictures, some videos, some podcasts. Go to Facebook, go to Twitter, the social media platforms. Interact with us. There's a phone number you can call me. There's an email address you can email me. But Page4TN.com, be sure to go there. Check it out. Spread the word for us. Guys, this is a big fight that we have. We really, if we miss this opportunity to coalesce and to show the establishment in both parties, me being an independent does not change the fact that I'm a personal conservative and that I'm looking out for liberty. That doesn't, it, you know, I'm an independent because of the situation that was before us. But we will show these party establishment types that Tennessee is ready to look out for Tennessee, and we're willing to elect one of our own this year at all costs to throw the parties away. And that's what I'm finding on the campaign trail. People say we're voting against the incumbent, we're voting against the parties, and we want one of our own up there. And if we just cannot afford to miss this opportunity because it may not come back around again. And there's so many things hanging in the balance. I'm sure we're going to talk about those. But reach out to us through social media, through the website, call, email, and let's get together in your neck of woods. Let's put an event together, a small rally or a meeting or whatever, and let's get this done. We've got opportunities for you to volunteer and to be a part of this. We have a strategy and a gameplay, but we need people to help us.
All right. I know it's one of the nastier sides of the truth about running a campaign at this level. How are you doing financially, campaign-wise? Are you having a reasonable amount of contributions? Are you getting the help?
That is always the million-dollar question with the $5 answer. The primary – let me just say this. Every time I needed a dollar, Tim, I had the dollar. And there were days when I'm like, I'm going to need X amount of money tomorrow, and I don't have it. And before I needed it, I had it. And, you know, call it what you will. I call it the hand of God working in our favor. I believe he called me to run this race, did not say I was going to win it. Please put every dollar. I've never had to say, you know what, we don't have the money to do that. It would be nice if the treasure chest was loaded down with thousands of dollars and we could do all these other things. But it's going to be nice if we win this thing and say, you know what, we did this on X amount of money. We do have some people ready to write some fairly large checks right now since the primary has ended. And they have committed to that. It's going to be a huge shot in the arm to us. It's going to help us get some name recognition across the state. And, you know, I'm just we'll take every donation you'll send our way. Most of those have been, you know, $10 and $25 donations. But we do need that help in that regard, and we appreciate every dime that is donated, contributed, because I know how hard I have to work for my money, and I don't take what you give for granted. We bought some yard signs, and I personally financed that, and, well, financed it out of my budget. I didn't borrow any money for it. But
right.
And so I get that. It costs a little money. You know, even if you're not doing any commercials or ads or signs, you still got to pay for gas, and you got some hotel stays here and there, things of that nature. I don't believe that it costs $5 and $10 million to run a campaign. That's what the politicians have convinced us, and there's a huge political campaign economy that takes place this time of year, and it's crazy. You know, the radio ads go up in price, and there's signs and advertisements everywhere. But we need some help. But I'll believe that the money will be there every time we need it, because that's the way it's been from day one.
Well, I kind of agree with your assessment of probably what's behind the needs being supplied as they're needed.
Right.
However, for everybody who's listening and anybody who wants to help out, Danny's already mentioned his website, and we'll give you another opportunity to give out that information before we let you go today. It's the unfortunate truth, and it's the ugliest side of politics, other than the fact that some people are willing to do whatever it takes to win, regardless of principle. But the fact that you've got to have enough cash to put yourself out there in front of the majority of people. And that being a limiting factor, from what I've seen and from what I've heard, I honestly think that you're doing a very good job of getting your name out there. Most people know you or have at least heard of you at this point, whether they know what you're doing yet or not. It's a little harder to keep in front of the folks that aren't political junkies like the folks
right.
who typically listen to this show. But let's take a step back and let's imagine for a second that you have won that election, and I, for one, would be very happy if that was the case, because I have had enough of Lamar, and I certainly don't want to take a step closer to the Democrats locking down further control of the Senate. The agenda is just too scary to me. But if you won, what exactly do you think should be our role in the world? Because this is one of those questions that a lot of folks get on here and really grill our candidates about. When Joe Carr was on, I had a gentleman call in who was giving Joe absolute Hades about his stand on Israel. And unfortunately, I was off air. I wasn't actually listening at that very second, because I was talking to somebody else that wanted to talk to Joe, but it was getting to the point where it was time for him to leave, and I was trying to do the smooth things with the caller, and then I got back to it, and what really surprised me is, first of all, the caller had called here before and typically is very respectful. He asks tough questions, but he's usually very respectful. He doesn't normally keep hammering and hammering on the same thing, which he did, and I have extended official apologies to Joe and his campaign at that point, but I still think that really wasn't quite enough to make them happy at the moment, and I can't blame him. Ultimately, that's still my responsibility on that, so I will, again, on air, apologize and acknowledge that. But let's move here. You've managed to win the election. What should our role be involving, let's say, something like Hezbollah in Israel, for example?
Okay. And I happen to hear that exchange between Joe and the caller, and here's the deal. If elected to Senate, whoever it is, they're going to get some tough questions, and they ought not be able to walk away. They ought not be able to cry uncle, him, save me, anything of that nature. You're the senator, and you've got to be able to face the music from time to time. My stance on Israel, I love Israel. I think Israel can be an ally and has been an ally in the region. I think that they are a beacon of hope in a very dark place in the world. Israel does not mistreat Arabs that are in their country. They get a vote. Arabs get a vote in the Israeli election process. They're well taken care of over there. The problem with Israel and the reason that we continue to have problems is because we tie their hands. We tell Israel they can't fight back. Britain tells Israel they can't fight back. France, Germany, you can't fight back, Israel. Let them defend their land, and the Arabs will stop the nonsense. You know, they won the war in 6 days, back in the 60s and in the 70s, and took land from the Arabs, and I think that's a fair deal. If you come and attack me, I get to take your stuff if I beat you. That's what war's all about. But we want to send money to Israel, and then we want to use that to say, okay, Israel, you can't fight back unless we say so. No, Israel gets to fight back. And if it costs Israel that money that we send over there, which it's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money compared to what we send into some other places. And quite frankly, I think we need to reexamine all of the money we send everywhere. But Israel needs to be said, hey, that's your property, that's your people, it's your homeland, defend it. Defend it. Well, now, we're not coming over there and putting boots on the ground defending it for you. You defend your – if that was happening, if Hezbollah was in Canada launching rockets into Detroit or New York or wherever, we would have none of it. We would blow them back into the Stone Ages, and Israel ought to have every right to do so. They do have the right to do so. America and some other nations are bullying them to prevent it. We need to get out of the way.
So, in essence, you're saying that our role should be to unhandcuff them and let them do what they need to do?
You know, we can send a message out. You know, how about this? Since our president likes to do the Twitter and do hashtag bring back our girls and all these things, hashtag all Hades is going to break loose, Hamas and Hezbollah, if you launch another rocket or whatever. Put them people on notice. Put those terrorist organizations on notice. Hey, we give them the green light to unload on you and to kill every one of you. And yes, I know innocent men, women, and children are being killed, and that happens in war all the time. In World War II, American bombs and British bombs killed a lot of innocent people in Europe because they were in the middle of a war zone. That happens. It's sad. It's tragic. We're not intentionally trying to go after them. That happens in war. It always has, and it always will. We need to send a message to the jihadist, a message to the terrorist. There's no handcuff. The dog is off the leash, and the dog's going to come and get you because Israel is well capable.
They certainly are. And, yeah, I have to admit, with the recent activities over there, Israel has done more to try and protect innocent civilians than any military ever has before.
Ever.
The bottom line here in this particular conflict is Israel wants to live in peace. Hamas wants to kill every living Jew.
Right.
You can't negotiate with that. You can't have the kumbaya moment and hug it out the way certain members of our administration and other Hollywood types would like to think you can. And if you're going to tell Israel, oh, no, we're going to condemn you for blowing up a hospital, or we're going to condemn you for blowing up a school, well, where's the condemnations for Hamas hiding in those hospitals and those schools and launching rockets from there? Yes, I firmly agree with you. It's not a case for we need to have boots on the ground. I certainly wouldn't call for that, but we definitely, like you say, need to have a much stronger presence on the world stage in support of Israel and not so much Hamas. Because ultimately, the people that are really getting the rawest deal here, it's not the Israelis, although innocent people are dying there. It's the people of Gaza, the people that didn't vote for Hamas but ended up stuck with Hamas anyway. I mean, Hamas got roughly 40% of the votes in that election to put them in charge. They're being victimized by the people that are supposed to be their government, their leadership, and they're being used as cannon fodder in a PR campaign to be used worldwide. And our media, and the media worldwide for that matter, is playing right along with the Hamas side of it and not painting the true picture. The very fact that they try to draw a moral equivalency to what Hamas is doing and what Israel does is not only just sickening, but it also shows the level of gullibility that exists around the world for the people that just don't know any better. Similar context, a little bit different situation, though. What do you think the U.S. role should be in engaging with ISIS?
That's a tough one right there, Tim. I may alienate some people here. And for any new listeners that don't know me, I am a Christian, a devout Christian. I have pastored two churches, youth pastor. I've spent a couple hours at church this morning. That's who my family, that's who we are, what we do. We're heavily involved in the kingdom of God and spreading the word of God. We got a mess in Iraq, and part of what we've done over the past decade is brought on this mess. That stuff didn't go on, and hear me out right here because some people are going to gasp. That stuff didn't go on when Saddam Hussein was the dictator. Now, he did some bad things, and he was a bad man, and he got what he deserved. You reap what you sow, and he reaped what he had sown. But we've left a vacuum over there. The people that came up into leadership had no business in leadership. They're not leaders. They don't have the support of the people. It's just an absolute mess. And here come the jihadists. And I just dread clicking on Facebook some days, Tim, and seeing the news and seeing the piles of bodies. And it breaks my heart as a human, breaks my heart as a Christian, and I'm to pray for them. The church, Christian church in Iraq is suffering persecution like we see in Bible days, like we see shortly after, what we would consider Bible days. It's not new. It's just really, and the thing is, it goes on all over the world all the time, but due to today's media, the internet, and social media, we're seeing the pictures, and it's really bad. And as a Christian, I want to help. I really do. We've got this document called the U.S. Constitution, and it does not empower the federal government to do a thing about it. And so if we want to be constitutional, we have to admit that our hands are kind of tied as a government to go over there and to bomb ISIS off the face of the earth, even though I'd love to do it. But let me talk as a Christian here for a moment. Not that I haven't been any other, but in regards strictly to the Word of God, the Kingdom of the Bible tells the church that when you're doing the will of God, that you will suffer persecution. The church, the Christians in the book of Acts were out about the Father's business. The testimony was that they had turned the world on its ear. Just 12 men had turned the world on its ear. And they, all of the disciples but one were killed, and they tried to kill him, and they killed countless other members of the church. It was just terrible. And then the Roman Empire was killing them all until what's his name, Constantine, had a encounter with God, and he put a ceasefire, an end to the persecution. But then what happened to the church? The church got comfortable. The church fell into what we call the Dark Ages and all kind of doctrines and doctrines of men and all kind of, you know, we can get into all kind of church history right there. But persecution
right.
keeps the church on its ear. And that sounds so awful to say. But the reason we don't have persecution like that in America is because the American church is comfortable. The American church is rather watching NASCAR or football instead of reading their Bible and praying and witnessing to their neighbors. The American church is backslid, and we will never see that form of persecution here. Not that the government would come and bail us out if we did. I think there's some in the government just assume see ISIS coming over here and beheading people. But it's not going to happen because we're not a threat to their religion. But the church in Iraq, the church in India, the church in China, the church in most of those Middle Eastern lands in Africa, they are a threat to the Muslim religion because Muslims are converting by the hundreds, if not the thousands, daily. Because those Christians believe and practice what they believe. And so our duty is to pray for them and to pray for that God would supernaturally help them. But I personally believe that constitutionally there is nothing American can do about it.
Okay, and that's fair enough. And I have to agree with you on that point. I myself, though, I personally tend to think I fall into the mindset of
it's a tough one, Tim. It's a tough one.
Right. Well, the rise of this caliphate has not only to do with the fact that we went in there and deposed Saddam, and you made a great point historically in the fact that Saddam was a secularist. He was part of the Ba'ath Party. They didn't like the Prophet of
right.
Islam being involved with the ideologies and how the government was working. In fact, I never once heard Saddam Hussein make a statement involving Islam until after U.S. troops were in Baghdad and he was in hiding and he was calling for
right.
help.
Right, absolutely.
But, you know, I do kind of tend to think that we do have a responsibility at this point because of what we've already done.
Yeah, we kind of brought it on them. So in that regard, you know, you know, our president pulled our troops out, and now he says he didn't do it, but George Bush did, and that's just craziness, Tim. If we had
yeah.
people there, we could put a stop to it. I really don't know what the remedy. I'm not a constitutional scholar, but the Bible says, and again, I'm gonna go back to the Bible because I'm a Christian. The Bible says in the Book of Revelation. To that this will transpire in Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. And it says
yes.
that he calls his people out to flee from there, and it becomes the haven of every foul spirit. And that has got ISIS written all over it. You think of all the sins, all the crimes that you could possibly think of, that's who ISIS is. They have... They're coming on the scene, and they're making Adolf Hitler look like a choir boy. And if they keep going the way they're going, they're certainly going to prove that to be true. But the Book of Revelation, I think it's chapter 18, specifically points to this activity in Iraq. And, I feel like maybe the only answer is for Christian church to get out of Iraq. And if we want to go over there and help them people get out, I'm good with that situation, helping them move somewhere in the world. I ain't talking about bringing a bunch of refugees over here. I really don't know exactly what the answer is for that. It's a big one.
Yeah. Well, in truth, there is no easy answer, or else somebody would have already done it. I mean,
yeah.
It is just that simple.
We need to be praying.
Right. In fact, On that same topic before we switch up, that was exactly the point our pastor made this morning, is that every single Christian here needs to be praying for direct intervention by God, not only for the purpose of working Christians, but for converting some of those Muslims so that they can come to recognize, just like Saul did, also
yes.
in the Book of Acts, how wrong things have been to this point. All right, let's shift gears. I mean, again, it's tough. I am concerned a little more about the caliphate. Their operational area is a lot more than what most people are hearing. If you were watching the news, you'd think it was limited to northern Iraq, and that's simply not the case. They control large sections of Iraq. They're right up. They have small portions of Iran now. They are operating inside Jordan. They have portions. They're right up to the border of Saudi Arabia. They went from being a movement to a standing army. And, of course, the big thing this past week, everybody in the social media world kept pointing out the fact that we've been seeing ISIS flags flying in American cities, on front porches, on the fence to the White House. Threats have been made. These people are fanatical. So, like you said, there's no simple solutions. And I, like I said, constitutionally speaking, you're dead on. That we really don't have much. If we're going to go strict constitutionally, and if that's what we're going to do, we have to abide by that, whether we like the outcome of it or not. There's really not a lot we can do. So there's a couple more questions I wanted to get to before I let you go. And, of course, now we're getting into the last few minutes that you're scheduled to be here. So, and I hate to cut you short because these are both really important, I think. Number one, I want to get to this before I get to the last one, and that is what do you do as senator to try and deal with the current crisis on the border?
All right. Let's move through this real quick. Here's the thing with the border. Obviously, I see it as a 3-4-step situation. We've got to secure that border. We can secure that border. The Chinese built a wall between them and a Genghis Khan that you can see from outer space. We can build a fence. We can get it done. We can employ technology. We can get it done. We've got to not talk about E-Verify, but we've got to mandate E-Verify. I can go into many, many, many businesses here in Nashville, Tennessee, and there's illegal aliens working there. How does that happen? It happens because businesses are not held accountable. Those things have got to be done. But if we lock the border down tight, if we make it where businesses cannot, will not hire, they're still going to find a way to get here somehow, some way. And why? Because their governments in Mexico and Central America are corrupt. They always have been corrupt. They're not going to change. The Mexican people are very nationalistic people. I know a lot of them. I've been around a lot of them. They love Mexico. They really do. Good grief, they send all their money back home every Friday, which is stealing wealth right out of our economy, never to come back. That's another problem. But we need revolution to take place in Mexico. That government needs to be overthrown by the Mexican people. The drug lords need to be overthrown by the Mexican people. They have the 14th largest economy in the world. They make more automobiles in Mexico than we make in the United States than Canada makes in Canada. They have oil. They have natural gas. They have a great tourism economy. They can stand on their own except for their government is corrupt. Their government is corrupt by nature. Their government is racist by nature. The light-skinned European descendants rule the land in Mexico and Central America, and the darker-skinned Native American descendants are poverty and impoverished. There's very, very, very small middle class in Mexico. It's growing a bit now, but I would love to see a Mexican Spring happen where the Mexican people rise up at whatever the cost, and overthrow their government. I don't want boots on the ground in Mexico, even though we've done that many times through the existence of the United States. You know, Mexico's always been a problem. But let's quit treating symptoms. Amnesty has got to come off the table. Lamar Alexander said this week that it is a shame that Congress has not passed amnesty. The guy campaigned and said that he ended amnesty. And now he says it's a shame that we haven't passed it. Full-fledged amnesty is going to come up for a vote in Congress next month. They've been waiting for these primaries to be over. All the primaries will end on September 9th. You can mark it down. Amnesty's coming, and if they don't pass it in Congress, Obama's got a phone and a pen, and he's going to do it, and it's going to wreak havoc on our economy. But we got to start treating and have solutions if we quit treating symptoms. There's no cure for the common cold. All you do is prolong it. The only cure for the Mexican situation is for Mexico to have a good form of government and elect their people and to have a good economy where they want to stay home. I believe you see most of them move back home. That's what they want. Tell me, Iraqi refugees are in the United States, and then they go back home after the war. Then they've been here for 10, 20, 30 years. But when they have an opportunity to live under a constitutional government, they go back home because they love their homeland.
And as well they should. And that's part of the problem that everyone that is on this side of the fence really doesn't seem to get. They're not coming here to become Americans.
Right.
So there's really not a need to offer a path to citizenship. Most of them don't want it. And it's a further insult to all the people who've taken the time and the effort to come here legally. Again, it absolutely kills me. I get to the point, especially here recently with a couple of folks, and I won't name them on air because they're probably listening or they'll catch the podcast, but I have had one-on-one conversations with a couple of folks, and I just want to shake them because they keep talking. Just keep talking about how it's the humanitarian thing to do when, in truth, no conservative is against immigration. We're against not having control over who, how, when, and why people are crossing our borders.
Right.
That's it. We want to know who's coming because, guess what? There are plenty of people from Middle Eastern countries crossing our southern border. I don't think they're coming for the scenic view of the Space Needle.
Right.
At any rate, I definitely with the last few minutes here, and we can run a little long if you want to. I've got about a five-minute buffer.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about this. This is something that they're really starting to talk about now. It may finally be something that the left and the right can kind of get together on for different reasons, but... the militarization of the police, this has become a major topic because of what's been happening in Ferguson this past week, but we've been seeing it for a while, the buildup. There's a quote that I saw that's actually from Battlestar Galactica, the sci-fi, but it's very appropriate. The leader, Commander Adama, later Admiral Adama, makes a statement that you know, the police and the military can't be the same because the military fight the enemy of the state and the police serve and protect the people. When the military become the police, the enemy tends to become the people.
Right.
What we need, do we need to be overly concerned about it? Is this, I know for a lot of the more hard right Tea Party type folks that tend to listen to the show and, I love you guys for listening, by the way. This has been a big deal on their radar for a long time now. What's your take on it? Should we make moves to move away from it? What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, it's becoming more and more and more problematic. I understand how a police officer may feel when he's out there walking the beats, bad parts of town. I can't imagine the fear and all the possibilities, the thoughts that go through your mind. You want to be prepared. You want to be protected. And the situation that happened in Ferguson, if I'm working for the police department, you know, I want to call in sick today. They say, hey, we got to roll up in the middle of this riot. So it's a bad situation, but our police can serve. They're not a defense force. And, you know, I live in Greenbrier, Tennessee, up in Robertson County, and I work in a lot of these small towns and counties across the state, and I see these heavily armed equipment showing up at police departments provided by the Department of Homeland Security. You know, they look like they rolled straight out of Iraq and Afghanistan. What are those for? What are we doing? And I've got to the point, Tim, that I despise seeing an unmarked police car. You're supposed to protect right. and serve. I need to know, hey, there's a police car over there, and if I need help, that person can provide it to me. But more and more of them are completely unmarked. Now, granted, if it's a Chevy Impala around here or a Dodge Charger, odds are it's a cop. But, you know, they haven't quite, you know, just using any old car they can find. They buy these in fleets. But I've really got a problem with what our police force, and a lot of them are military guys, and everybody knows I love our military, and I've got some great hopes, things that we can do for our military to make our military stronger, better, and honor our military. Some of these guys come home straight from the war zone, they join the police department, and they've never made the disconnect that they're not in Afghanistan anymore. There's not a guy standing on the corner here in Robertson County ready to slip an IED up under your car, okay? It's okay.
Right.
We're your friends, we're your neighbors. And I had an incident here when I moved to Robertson County last fall. The day I moved in, I was hauling a mattress in my truck, had my three boys with me, and I was speeding. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was speeding on a backcountry road. Like I said, it was day one that we moved in, and the officer came, and I showed him my carry permit, and he asked me if I had a weapon on me, and I said I did, and I was wearing a pair of shorts. I said, it's in my pocket. And I even told him, I said, officer's not even around chambered. And he got me out of the truck. He frisked me. He took my gun, and he tried to handcuff me. And I said, what are we doing here? He said, you have an illegal weapon on you. I said, no, sir. I gave you my permit. He said, as far as I'm concerned, that permit is illegal. It's fake. I said, well, it's just like my driver's license that you also have issued by the same state. No, it's not fake. And he called for backup. My son called my wife because I thought he was arresting me. And my son called my wife, and the officer said, if anybody shows up here, I'm taking everybody to jail, your wife, your kids, everybody's going to jail. And I said, well, he's on the phone with his mother right now. And he went to the passenger door of my vehicle, opened it up, and told my son to get off the phone. My three boys are in the truck crying because they see Dad getting handcuffed and arrested, and the cop comes and threatens them not to be on the phone. I actually crossed over into another town, so the other police department showed up and defused the situation. And the cop said, I said, you're violating my constitutional rights. He said, I know I am. And when he gave me my gun back, he had completely disassembled it, and he said, don't you dare put this gun back together until I am out of your sight. Mm. That guy doesn't need to be a police officer.
You're right. I probably, unfortunately, would not have been able to hold my tongue. I would have probably asked something real smart-lucky like, how are my kids supposed to get home if their mom can't show up?
Right. Well, my wife showed up. I'm like, keep going. He's going to arrest you. Keep going. But we got away with it. I had to pay a speeding fine, which was fair enough because I was. But he told us, he said, I'm not going to let anybody have a weapon at my traffic stop. Like, it's crazy, man. I'm legally carrying this. But, yeah, you know, it's a problem.
All right. It is, and, you know, I think the biggest problem is that we've really got to take a closer look at who our police officers are. I have police officers that do unquestionably one of the toughest jobs there is to do on the planet. Most of them, I think, are good cops.
Yes, absolutely.
Unfortunately, you do get a few bad ones here and there that get a little, I don't know if it's just a power trip or if they're still suffering from a little post-traumatic syndrome from their military service, because a lot of them have spent time But either way, we do need to take a closer look because they need to be held to a higher standard. And if they're not capable of meeting that standard, it's understandable if you're in a situation. But if you can't meet that standard, then you need to step down and let somebody else can. One more time real quick before I let you go, go ahead and throw out your websites, your contact information, and we'll let
you
get that done real quick.
You shoot me an email at danny@page4tn.com. The website, of course, is page4tn.com. We have a like page and a friend page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at page4tn.com. You know, if you've got 10 or 20 extra bucks, help us out. Call us if you want to volunteer. Right there at the top of the website, it says get involved. There's a media tab at the top of the website. You'll hear podcasts, pictures, videos, articles. Like, there's just so much information on that website. You can't hardly not know who I am or what I'm about. But we need to get this done. Liberty's at stake. Lamar Alexander, we know how he votes. We know who he is. We know what he's about. He's the grandfather of Common Core. He's pushing amnesty. We have got to beat Lamar Alexander. The kingpin must be beat this fall, and I need your help. Page4tn.com. I really appreciate this opportunity, Tim. Thank you so much.
All right. I appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll see you at least one more time before the actual election. Best of luck
Sounds
to
good.
You, and you have my support, sir.
Thank you very much.
All right,
Sounds
and
good.
God bless.
You guys have a great day.
All right. That was Danny. I got to tell you, he's got my support at this point. Now, patiently, having waited on the line for a few minutes, I want to welcome our next guest, Dr. Sharon Schutz. How are you today, Sharon?
I'm doing just fine, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Sorry about the little bit of overlap there onto your time.
No problem.
I had a feeling you'd understand. First of all, I want to say thank you for coming on the show again. You are without doubt one of my favorite guests, as probably evidenced by how often you're on.
Well, I enjoyed being on your show.
Go ahead.
I was going to say I enjoy being on your show. I've not been on radio in a while. We've had a lot of things happen, and so it's nice to be back. It's nice to be involved and working at Lady Patriots and doing all the things that I love doing so much. And I appreciate you calling and asking me, contacting me.
Like I was saying, I've kind of been away from it for a little while myself, and I couldn't think of two people I would rather have on under the circumstances for my first show back over here than you and Danny. While we're on the topic, we really haven't spoken a whole lot. You've had a lot of stuff going on in your personal life, had a little bit of stuff going on in mine. It doesn't quite compare to everything you had going on, but I am glad to see you back in the fight. I had seen you writing more and more articles over at Lady Patriots. How are things going at the website?
Oh, they're going great. I was out for several months. I lost my brother. And then 3 days later, I lost my sister, and then my husband got sick and had to have surgery. And then I broke my arm and was in a cast that I couldn't move. I couldn't turn. I couldn't do anything. So for about 4 months, I was just totally, totally out of it. And during that time, things slowed down a lot. But we had a couple of people that were continually working things and were very helpful. But they weren't me, and I work it 24/7 if I need to, and I've been working with Lady Patriots and started doing a lot more writing and gotten a lot more involved building more websites and getting things back together, and I'm excited. I'm feeling really good. The numbers are coming up, and I'm just really excited what's happening.
Well, I know I'm very glad to hear that, and I know every other person that has become a fan of the Lady Patriot website must be as well. I've noticed you've revamped the site a little bit. I think the writing has taken an uptick, and your guys' level of coverage has also, it appears to have improved a great deal, I think, just recently.
It has. We, like I said, when I was out for that time period, there was very little different news. It was more of opinion stuff, and things weren't covered like they are now. I try to make sure that, you know, we cover the main issues. We miss a lot, but I try to, you know, get more involved in different areas now that I'm writing and gotten back involved again. And so it's definitely a lot more sources, a lot more information, a lot more news, and a lot more people. There's a lot of, you know, we lost a lot of followers. I say a lot. To me, you know, we lost about 400 people. On Facebook, that's when you have, you know, almost 82,000 people. That doesn't seem like a lot, but it does when you realize that you lost those followers. You know, they're not, I mean, they left, but they're coming back, and that's wonderful. Our numbers are growing again, and it's exciting to see and to be part of that again.
Great. Well, you know, I don't think there's any question that right now is quite possibly the most important time to be back into the fight, and I'm, for one, glad to see you back in it. And yeah, you're right. It is kind of disheartening. I saw a lot of visits to my website and my Facebook page kind of drop off. People stopped paying quite as much attention as the show went away. But it seems like since I've been back, like I said, I started a little bit over at Spreaker again, kind of, and a little inconsistently, but it seems like people are coming back a lot faster. And there's a lot more new people, too. So obviously more people are paying attention than before, and I think that's a great opportunity. But
right.
That in and of itself is a victory, and we're glad to have you back in the fight. Me speaking for all conservatives everywhere, even the ones that don't know it yet, they will be glad once they know what's going on. You, for the process of writing one of your more recent articles, actually went to the border, and that was the starting point that I wanted to jump on with you.
Okay.
Because actually people on the ground, seeing what's going on at the border, that you're not hearing those stories a whole lot. You're just not. So
right.
What did you see? What did you see while you were there?
Well, first let me explain the circumstances. My husband was born and raised in Falfurrias, Texas. I've been there many times through the years. His family actually was part of founding the town. His great aunt, we called her, everybody that knows her called her Tante Schutz, was the school teacher from the time she was 14 years old in their one-room schoolhouse back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And she died in the 80s, and she wrote the history of the town. She was one of the founders. And so we were discussing it. Michael still got, you know, of course, most of his family is still in that area. And we were discussing Falfurrias, and I'm like, why don't we go there? Because, you know, it's home. And so we went, and we called before we went. We made arrangements to meet with one of the ranchers. And we tried to get a hold of Michael Vickers, who has done a lot of publicity and stuff, but we kept missing each other, and we had to leave before we could get together. But anyway, we're going to be going back, at the end of this month or the first part of next month. There's a meeting going to be taking place, and we've been invited to that. But we went there and met with this rancher, and we went to the local newspaper and talked to them. And then they suggested that we talk to one of the justices of the peace, a precinct, I think precinct two, I'm not sure. But and so we went and we sat down with her, and she gave us, of course, the name and number for the chief deputy sheriff there, and Benny Martinez. And we went and sat down with him. And I tell you, those were the most gracious people that I've ever met. I mean, they were wonderful. And the one thing that we saw that really broke our heart, like I said, we've been there many times for funerals, for, you know, to visit my husband's parents, to visit the family, but I've never seen Falfurrias like it is now. There is such a depression, such a tremendous depression over that area. and it's like, you know, they're just stuck. And what's happening is in the people coming across the border at McAllen and down along the border, everybody has to funnel through Brooks County because that's where 17 miles from South Urias into the south is where they have a Border Patrol station. So to avoid the Border Patrol station, the coyotes drop the people off in the edge of the desert, and they walk 30 miles around that Border Patrol station past South Urias, and then they're supposed to be picked up on the other side. But what's happening is these people are getting out in the desert with a limited amount of water, a limited amount of resources. They get lost. They walk around out in the heat. They start getting weak, and when the weaker ones get weak, the others leave them because they're in groups of 20 or 30. And so they're constantly finding bodies out there. And so anyway, we sat down with the Justice of the Peace, and she showed us autopsy reports of people and children, and it was heartbreaking because these people are coming into the country, and they're anticipating this wonderful life they're going to have, and then they get out in that desert, and so many of them die. But the problem that South Urias is facing, and I'm my heart just is broken for them as a county, they have to pay for everything involved with finding these bodies, getting them into the place where they the funeral home, getting them autopsied. They have to pay all of the fees. But because they're not a border county and they're inland from the border somewhat, the federal government says that they don't need any help financially. So they are paying $2,300 per body they find out of their own pocket. Well, it's a small county, and they don't have any money. And so they're having to actually dig into everything. They've taken pay cuts. They've lost their medical insurance. They can't afford all the deputies. They've had to cut back on staff. Now they have to even clean their own offices and empty their trash and clean their own toilets in there because they can't afford the niceties that they could afford a couple of years ago before this started. Because every dollar they get has to go into taking care of these dead bodies, and they have to pay for it. That just broke my heart because, you know, I know it just doesn't make sense. And they don't see any need to it.
This is definitely a story that you're not hearing. Oh, okay. This is a story you're definitely not hearing being reported in the media. In fact, the border is kind of almost moved away from what's going on at the border. And
right.
The media is trying to move away from what's going on between Israel and Hamas. Everybody wants, at least our media, wants to pivot towards Ferguson because, again, this advances, at least at the moment, their effort to try and put forth this notion that we're a racist nation, which we all know is a bunch of hooey.
Right.
There are racist people in the country, yes. Is there institutional racism going on? I don't believe that to be the case in most situations. Can't swear to it as far as each individual place, but I'm nowhere near. But, I mean, people aren't talking about what's still going on there, and they certainly haven't been focused on the impact of the people living in those border towns and in those counties that are nearby that are facing this. How is it that we're not hearing these stories more? Why don't we have more media covering that aspect? Because I think this goes to the true American spirit. We want to be, we want to be very charitable. It's in our nature.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's ingrained in our DNA, quite honestly.
It is.
I know people personally who've given more than they really could afford to give to somebody just because they saw they were in worse shape than they were.
Right.
So we're a very gracious and altruistic society. I guess let's pivot a little bit because, you know, that it's mind-boggling to me that we're not hearing these stories except from just a few little outlets here and there. If you're not already reading The Lady Patriots, you probably hadn't heard that. But there may be somebody else that's covering it, but I haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So I know some of the more obscure places on the web I occasionally check. By now I would have thought I would have. Let's pivot a little bit.
Perry,
of course, Governor Perry has decided to move. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and then one of the things that I run into is that people don't read it at Breitbart, or they don't read it at CNN, or they don't read it at Yahoo News, so therefore it doesn't exist. And, you know, the thing is, like in this case, now I didn't have anybody come against what I wrote because I was there, but, you know, that's one of the problems that you run into is you go out, you find your sources, you get your material, you have your contacts who are very, very, good contacts. And then because you're not coming from one of these, then, you know, people question it. And so I see that a lot. Now, in Lady Patriots, we have a reputation for truth, and I'm a stickler when it comes to truth. There's websites out there that will just grab any story off the web and repeat it without checking into it. And I won't do that. I'm going to find a lot of times what I'll do is I'll find a source, and you know, all these websites have the same story, and you go back, and it all comes from one source. And, and sometimes it's even satire sites. And so you have to be very careful. But I do know that there are some that, you know, I know that Breitbart did a recent article. In fact, it came out the same day that I wrote my article, or the day before, I think, because someone was there that had done an article. And in fact, I saw in the chat room somebody mentioned the deputy that made $11 an hour. You know, he was actually there, and he did the story, and it was a great story. I think it was Breitbart. I'm not sure. But anyway, no. It was, I think, the Washington Post. It was the Washington Post. It was an excellent story. And but they were there. And there's not a lot of people that are actually traveling down there to find out what's going on. And so they don't, they're just repeating what they hear, you know, written in the, on the web somewhere.
All right. And Lady Michelle in the chat room, as a matter of fact, just did story along this line as well, and I would like to go ahead and take the opportunity to point out that Lady Michelle is one of our most interaction when it comes to the show and in the chat room. Hello,
Tim? You're breaking up.
Can you
I'm
hear
on
me?
A cell phone. I'm sorry.
All right. All right, but at any rate, what I was saying is that I always appreciate her activity in the chat room, and I am right now posting the link to that to the Tap Into the Truth Facebook page. So anybody who catches this on the podcast can look it up later. And again, thanks, Lady Michelle, for that. In your estimation, as far as what's going on with Governor Rick Perry, do you think that his reaction to the border crisis and the lack of the federal government, has it been appropriate?
I think he's done a very good job. I don't always agree with everything that he does and says, but in this case, in this instance, he is taking the lead in a very important issue, and he's doing what he can. At least I hope he's doing what he can, but he's doing, you know, he's got the soldiers there. He's got, you know, he's got things that, in fact, I saw a deal the other day that I think it was the lieutenant governor announced that they had shut down almost completely a 60-mile stretch of the border where people were constantly coming across, and that really helped a lot. But he's doing a good job, and I think that's why they're coming against him, because he is doing a good job. He's the only governor on the border who's actually trying to do something. So they have to come against him some way and get his focus off and make him fight a separate front. I mean, it's all, we're dealing with a war here, Tim. We are in a war. Right now, it's a war for the minds and hearts. And it's a war of ideas and a war of words. And the thing is, they don't care if what they bring out, like this district attorney, they don't care if it's true or if it makes sense. And ultimately, they know that he's going to win this. However, it's going to dissipate his energies and his focus, and that's ultimately what they're wanting. If they can get him to fret or focus or, you know, deal with this issue, then he's not going to have as much energy for other places and other things. Is that simple?
Well, you know, I can I can tell you this much. It's straight out of the playbook. We've seen him do it before. The same kind of attacks made against Sarah Palin that made her decide to resign the governorship in Alaska because she didn't want to continue to spend the taxpayers' money to fight that fight. What ultimately comes down here, though, is you do have somebody who's standing up for Texas and who
right.
is under constitutional authority
mm-hmm.
stepping up and doing what the federal government refuses to do. But
yeah.
we continue to keep hearing these statements about how it's not the humanitarian thing to do. We have to take care of these kids and all other stuff. And, yeah, I've been trying to make the point myself that I think it's far more humanitarian, given the rate at which the innocents that are involved with trying to cross these borders are being sent here, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
They're not coming of their own accord. All the actual minors, somebody's sending them here, and somebody's paying for that. But
right.
it would be far more humane if we sent the message strong, firm, once and for all, that there's no more crossing. Don't
mm-hmm.
send your children here.
Right.
Now, once they're here, do we have a certain responsibility to take care of them? Yeah, I'd say that we probably do.
Mm-hmm.
But that should be to the extent of making sure that they're well enough to travel and then sending them back home. There should
exactly.
be no talk about a – there should be absolutely no discussion about these kids getting to stay here long term.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just mind-boggling to me the fact that people don't seem to understand that people are paying a price for this. We saw the articles
right.
this past week in the Atlanta school system suddenly overwhelmed with these
mm-hmm.
children that are trying
right.
to be registered into classes. And there's little things like that that nobody on the left seems to understand is designed to collapse our system.
Exactly.
I mean,
and there's
anyway,
more to it than just collapsing our system. And there's a lot more to it. One thing, the school districts are not allowed to know ahead of time how many children are going to be coming to their school. The
right.
the whole thing is, and of course, everybody is, you know, is focused on the they're getting Democrat vote thing, and truly they are. We know that they're going to try to make them legal. They're giving them all of our money. They're taking our resources. You know, while we have homeless, we have vets that are homeless. We have people that are not being taken care of, that are being abused, and we're giving all that to them. That's horrible. But also, and this is something that you know, concerns me very much. I have pictures, and I've seen pictures and whatever of people that have come across Americans, Border Patrol agents who have gotten sick when dealing with these children. I have pictures of a Border Patrol agent that literally his entire body is almost eaten up. He's just one big scale. His hands and arms are just, you know, just you can't tell that except for the shape that it's human. And these things are happening everywhere. And the diseases that are being brought across the border are being shoved, not just on the border, but they're rushing these people into the United States, spreading them out everywhere, and getting these diseases all over the United States. Now, ultimately, in the end, it's going to be catastrophic. And you know, that might take – I'll tell you what, I've got a really cool tinfoil hat and my husband made me. I don't have it here. It's at my office. But, you know, I'll just say I'm wearing it. But the thing is, I did a story the other day on the Ebola centers where they're putting the Ebola centers at throughout the United States. And you take the two
mm-hmm.
maps, the map of where they're sending the people and where the Ebola centers are, and you lay one map on top of the other, and they match. Now, the thing is, I hear people say the Ebola thing is just a political tool, that it's, you know, just another scare tactic and whatever, and possibly it is. I hope it is. I hope that's what it is. However,
sorry.
We have diseases coming into our country that have been eradicated for decades and generations, and they're back. And they're back with such a force and a fierceness that it's just unbelievable. And, you know, I have a website that I go to every day, and I read some of the stuff they have. And I don't pay attention to all of it, but one doctor wrote in, and he said, you know, he said, no, I'm sorry, he was a dentist. And he said, he's in California, and he said, I decided, that, you know, with all this talk about Ebola and all this stuff, he said, I decided to go ahead and get some extra saline solution. And, you know, get some supplies and put back because you never know when you're going to be dealing with something. And so he made an order for saline solution. Now, he was told by the company that he always ordered his saline solution from that there is none available and that there won't be any available for a very long time. And he's like, why? And they said, we don't know. It just dried up. It's gone. So they can't get – now, and the saline solution is the very thing that they use to hydrate – patients with.
Right.
And so it's weird now. All these little things just don't add up, or they add up to something very seriously wrong. So I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe it's tinfoil hat, but I do believe that there's a sinister move afoot.
Well, it certainly is suspicious. Before addressing the Ebola stuff, though, I did want to touch on the fact that Lady Michelle in the chat room said that she starts back to work on this coming Friday, and she works in the school system, and her superintendent won't answer any of her questions about medical screening, immunizations, and even if they're going to see who can prove that they're American citizens or not. Now, I get American considering that's part of the left and how they like to activate. But when it comes to the fact that we have to prove immunizations for our children before we can drop them off and leave them in public schools, why shouldn't this information be available? Yeah, I mean, there are lots of questions. I mean, the saline solution, I would not think that would be even difficult to manufacture even if they were running low. So,
you know, I wouldn't either. In fact, I talked to my husband about it, and I said, it's just salt water. I mean, you know, with few things in it, and it just doesn't make sense to me, but it's not available, according to this dentist. And you've got to have saline solution for any kind of IV medicine. And I know that they say that the hydration is the only thing you can really do for an Ebola patient. So,
right.
And that's the only source that I've heard this from. You know, it could be that this dentist just, you know, got it wrong. I don't know. But the thing is, the whole thing is just, as far as I know, it just doesn't make sense. And the way that, it doesn't make sense in, you know, in a normal, logical world. But the world that we live in now, Tim, is not normal and it's not logical. It changed back in 2008, and it went crazy. And so, you know, what's good is bad, what's bad is good, what's ugly is beautiful, what's beautiful is ugly. What's right is wrong. What's wrong is right. So everything has changed so much that, you know, when we say something, it sounds so ludicrous to most people who are not plugged in that, you know, it sounds like they're like, where did you get that? And, you know, and the truth is we have so many people in America that are still not plugged in, that are not listening, that they go to CNN or MSNBC and, you know, even Fox. And they get their news from there, and you know, and they don't realize what is actually happening in America. And when you say something to them, or you see their eyes roll, you know, and you know, you're like, oh,
right.
it's awful. So we never
right.
know. I mean, we hear these things, and we just never know. And ultimately, time is the only thing that will, you know, will prove it out. Time.
Well, speaking of the way the media goes and how people are paying attention, I kind of talked a little bit with Danny earlier about ISIS and how most people don't realize exactly how far their base of operations has extended and how they've actually become a genuine army at this point in the Middle East. I know you guys over there have been writing about this as well. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but isn't ISIS really kind of a civil war between Sunni and Shia? they're kind of fighting over the Sunni and the Shia, a way of deciding who's going to be in charge of the caliphate. And they're just kind of right now starting with the Christians to kind of pick them off so there's nobody to stand up with the other side. Yeah.
You know, Tim, I don't know. I really don't know. I know that ISIS has a lot of American support. There are a lot of people in the whole thing. When you look at the Middle East cauldron and the whole mix,
yeah.
Basically they're all the same. I mean, in all honesty, they might fight each other for a while, but they're all going to turn their guns on us. They're all going to turn their guns on Israel. You know, and right now I know that, you know, that Israel has support from some of the other nations because they know that once this ISIS and you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and, you know, whatever, once they win whatever they're doing now, that they're going to turn on them. But I don't know. I'm just at this point, I watch our government. I watch, you know, we look at our State Department. We look at our entire federal government, and it is full of Muslim Brotherhood members. You know, I mean, our whole nation has become Muslim ruled, and you know, and in fact, I was talking to somebody the other day. There's a young lady that lives here in the town that I live in, and she was raised Muslim. She was when she was 18, she was married to a man. I'm not sure where, Pakistan maybe. Anyway, she was from India, and her father was from Iran, and her mother was from Iran, her father was from India. And so she, you know, came to the United States. She was raised in Venezuela. She came to the United States, and she had an arranged marriage. She was married to this man for 17 years. He was Islamic. She was involved with his family, had 6 children, and finally she was able to leave him, get away, and now she's Christian. Wonderful, wonderful girl. We had a wonderful talk, and I'm going to be putting an article out and some videos. I'm going to be interviewing her and doing some really cool things with it. But one of the things we discussed, you know, and I asked her, I said, you know, is there such a thing as a real moderate Muslim? And she said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why is that? She said, the thing about moderate Muslims is that they still follow the Quran. And the thing is, Tim, moderate Muslims are only here changing our laws to theirs. They put a suit on, they get a law degree, and they go into the court and they change our laws. They follow our laws, but they don't lock our laws, and they want to change them. That's not moderate. That's just a different arm of the army, as far as I'm concerned. And I know that sounds awful. And believe me, there's wonderful, wonderful Muslims. There are. However, the majority of them, whether they're moderate or whether they're radical, and the majority are moderate. But their goal is ultimately Islam and Islam in America.
Yeah.
So we're
deep
doo-doo.
It typically seems to be that the pattern wherever Muslims to is they are moderate until they have sufficient numbers. Then they become more and more vocal. Then they start demanding compliance with Sharia, and then those
mm-hmm.
demands get louder. I mean, we've seen it even in talking about just ISIS itself, which is a tremendous threat right now. And, you know, they're very violent. I don't think we have seen these kind of tactics since the days of Genghis Khan. They're not
mm-hmm.
just going around killing Christians and other non-Muslims. They are literally doing this in the most horrific ways and making it as visible as possible, posting their 12-year-old kids holding up decapitated heads
right.
on Twitter, and it's they're telling us, hey,
mm-hmm.
Seattle, hope you're safe. Sleep tight tonight. We're coming to you. And then we see ISIS flags flying on the front porches in New Jersey and in California. And
mm-hmm.
you see somebody hang one on the fence at the White House, although I think it's a little late for them to try to bring the caliphate there, quite honestly.
yeah. absolutely.
We're living in very dangerous times, and we need to be prepared. I mean, I feel like I'm never doing enough to stand with the Christians in the regions that are currently being targeted by ISIS, because these people are dying because they're refusing to convert.
Right.
And that's absolutely what we have to keep in mind. We've seen this past week where the young boy of a pastor of a Christian church in northern Iraq had his son cut in half in front of him.
Right.
These people are brutal butchers who want nothing more than to terrify everyone that they're coming so no one will stand opposed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear one of these people say that they're coming to destroy all that will stand against Islam, well, then I want it made very clear that they need to know that my house has a target, because we here will stand opposed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You
and
know, when
they
I think
need
about
to understand that,
my granddaughters, I have five beautiful granddaughters and five wonderful grandsons. And when I think about my granddaughters having to live in a world ruled by that philosophy and that system, it makes me go, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You know, the thing is, America is in serious, serious trouble, Tim. They're coming in through the borders. I know that the MS-13 gangs in Mexico are paid $50,000 a head, a person, to bring terrorists across the border and get them into the United States safely. And they're coming in by the droves. What we're seeing on the cameras, on the television, is these poor little children who have blisters on their feet. And, you know, and that's all we're seeing. But what we're not seeing is the other 70% or 75% or whatever that are adults. What they're doing, Tim, is they're taking adults, and an adult will grab a child's hand and say, I'm your new papa, I'm your new mama, and they'll walk across and they'll get across the border, and then this is mama and daddy, and you know, and then that person becomes part of this new amnesty that's not really supposed to be happening. And we're allowing anybody and everybody with no papers. I just recently did an article. I had I was contacted by Saud Kelly. She her father was put in prison. I'm sorry. Her father was put in prison in for life for murder. I think it was in February when he was sentenced, and his brothers too. And they're a family from Mexico that have a big enterprise across the United States. I think like 33 states and 53 major cities in the United States where they do documentation for illegals. They, you know, for $200 or $300, they'll give you a fake driver's license, a fake birth certificate, utility bills, green card, everything you need to become an American and blend in. And the thing about these fake documents is that they are so good because they steal equipment and stuff from the state, you know, the highway departments and different places where they make the driver's license and they do all this. They get their software. They have contacts into every place. They have foot soldiers all over, and you can find them anywhere in any town that's got a strip mall that and a photo shop, a photo store in it. You're going to probably find that it's the front for one of these organizations. Anyway, she contacted me, and she had, when she was 21, she helped the government, Border Patrol. She helped the FBI, I think, and two or three different of the alphabet suits, Homeland Security. She helped them build a case against her family, who was doing this. I mean, we're talking a multi-million-dollar-a-year business. And she contacted me the other day, and she said, you know, she told me who she was. I checked into her. She's very real, very legitimate. She's been interviewed on, you know, on every major media for years. And she was telling me that the next generation, her cousins, are now running the business. And it's bigger and it's meaner and it's deadlier. And she was telling me what they're doing through the border. And it's scary, Tim. It's very scary. And I wrote an article on Lady Patriots, and you can find it there and, you know, on under my name. But anyway, it's really scary what's going on with this. And this new generation has they use drones at the border. And what they do, and these drones have been also weaponized, but what they do is they take these drones and they fly them, and so they know where the Border Patrol's at, and so they know where it's safe to, right, to get these terrorists across. And then they give them the paperwork, and they get them, you know, for $300, they got all the paperwork they need to be blend in and be an American citizen. And the whole thing about this paperwork, and this is what the story was that they told me, this family is working with the Obama administration to provide illegal documents, because when amnesty is called for and becomes law, they're going to backdate it and say, okay, everybody who's been here for, say, 5 years or however many, they can stay, but everybody else has to go. Well, what they're doing is for those that have been, you know, more recent, they're going to provide illegal documents, and the federal government is involved with this. And so, you know, it's really frightening what's coming into our nation and what our government is bringing into our nation. And, you know, and they have no concern, of course, at all for the citizens. We're just the problem. And that's basically what they see us as, is the problem. So we got a, right, we got the rocky road ahead of us.
Based on everything that you're seeing, do you think that as soon as all of the primary elections are done, or are we going to have to wait till after November, they're just going to move and go ahead and push amnesty through regardless? Is that coming without question, or is there a chance that that gets stopped? Based on what you've seen, what do you think?
I think amnesty's coming. We're not going to be able to stop it. But I would question them making a major move before the November election, because there's too many people that will be affected, too many Democrats that will get, you know, a backlash, and they don't want that. Now, I think at this point, Obama really doesn't care a whole lot. He's totally lost it. Obama's, you know, he's like living in this weird, warped world. And but the problem is, there's a lot of Democrats out there that are just as adamant against an immediate executive order, which, by the way, is not legal. But anyway, I feel like it would probably be logical that they would wait until after the November election, but who knows? You just never know what they're going to pull out of their head.
That's true. I mean, it really comes down to me. I'm not so convinced anymore that Obama cares about the election cycle, per se. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of Democrats out there that would like to get reelected that wouldn't. Ultimately, the issue is going to come down to what happens with the American public. What does it take to awaken them? I mean, I see signs here and there that reasons to be hopeful that it's happening, even amongst communities that previously have not wanted to be awake. You know, the facts have been right in front of them, but they intentionally look the other way.
Right.
Because either it's just what's easiest or convenient, or they still want to hang on to the notion that somebody is actually trying to do something for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very scary thought.
Most of us can remember our turning point. It's kind of like when you got saved, you know, as a Christian. Most of us who got saved as adults can remember the day, the hour, the minute, exactly the circumstances, and describe it in detail. That's what's happening in with people who wake up. You know, it might be a slow process, but it's a process. I started waking up, you know, in like 2008. It was 2010 before I really started seeing what was going on and started, you know, doing stuff. And then it was actually 2013 before I started finding my voice. But the thing is, what happens is when someone hears this reality that's not comfortable to them, they don't want to hear it, because that means change. Truth means change. And if you hear the truth and accept the truth and believe the truth, then you have to act on that truth. If nothing else, but change what you watch, what you read, what you do, who you hang out with. And people don't want to change because it's uncomfortable. And it won't be comfortable when they have to. Unfortunately, most people... And you ask about, you know, people changing, people waking up. I honestly believe it's just like human nature, and that's I have a PhD in human nature, and in human nature, Kim, we're not normally going to jump on major change, and we're not going to accept things real easily. And the thing is, our most of it, but what's going to happen, what has happened in just about every culture that's ever had this kind of change take over in incrementally like we are, the people don't wake up. Many do, many fight, many eventually die, do not wake up until the trucks drive up on their street and start pulling them out of their homes. And that's when they say, why didn't you say something? Why didn't somebody do something? Well, people like you and I have been. But that's what's going to happen in America, I'm afraid. Now, I could be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong. I would give anything to be wrong. I would love to see major change and wonderful things happen. But let me tell you something. Our nation is split. We're divided. We're divided more now than we've been divided ever. Even in the Civil War, we weren't divided like we are now. And the problem that I see is that tomorrow, if we voted in another Ronald Reagan, and we replaced the Senate, and we replaced Congress with conservatives who fought and believed in America, we would still have 50% out there who will fight it. And the problem is going to be, it's gotten to the point now, years ago they could placate whichever side was upset. You know, when Bush was in office, everybody placated the liberals. The liberals made all the nasty memes and the nasty accusations and all the ugly websites. They did those things against Bush. They say they didn't, but they did. But the thing is, now to swing back, we'll have blood in the streets one way or the other. And that's the problem we're going to have, Kim. We're at the point now, I believe, and I could be wrong, but we're at the point, I'm afraid, that major change in this country is going to come with blood. And, that's what they're wanting. That's exactly what they're working for. That's what Obama's working for.
It really still comes down to the fact, not only do we hope that it's wrong, but that's part of why we have both. I know you have picked up and found your voice. That's part of why I'm out here saying and trying to reach as many people as I can, because we're trying to avoid that. We're trying to reach anybody that's actually willing to listen and help them to understand not just the folks on the other side, but some of the folks on our side get caught up in the finger pointing, and we get caught up in, well, whose fault is this? And you did this first, instead of saying, all right, let's forget about that. Let's fix what this problem is. I mean, I have often posed the question before, why are Hispanics coming in across the border automatically votes for the Democratic side? Because when you look at the typical lifestyle of the average Hispanic family, they're generally very religious, very conservative nature. It doesn't seem logical. But then it occurred to me, what would happen if, say, we were a small group of only English-speaking people and we were in we're in Guatemala, and we're being isolated. Some politicians are constantly telling us, we don't understand the language. We never learned the language. So suddenly one group comes speaking English, and they tell us everybody else hates us. Look at what they're doing. And so then we're misled into thinking, well, these guys took the time to come here and teach us.
Right.
They learned our language, and now they're telling us this. Maybe we better act in our own interest. So a lot of these folks, I'm afraid, are being misled to following the side. We've definitely got to get a handle on influx. We've got to get control of our borders. We've got to get a better idea of who is the enemy. And unfortunately, at the moment, I'm afraid we have no choice but to face the reality that some of the enemy is operating within our government. We have been infiltrated. We are at risk. And we have people controlling media. I mean, when you look at something as simple as the fact that Al Jazeera and Russia Today are carried by most cable networks, but then turn around and say something like The Blaze, not that I'm trying to promote Glenn Beck at the moment or push his stuff. The Blaze has a hard time getting an audience. There won't be
right.
Comcast won't let them on.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't tell you everything you need to know, then you're not paying attention.
Exactly.
We're inside the last 5 minutes, so I wanted to go ahead and give you a chance to go ahead and tell everybody the website again, get some promotion going out there for the Lady Patriots, and then we'll go ahead and let you go. Go ahead, Erin, tell everybody about Lady Patriots and how they can find you and the site.
Okay. You can find us at lady-patriots.com, or you can find us on Facebook at Patriot Ladies, or Lady Patriots. You type it in the bar, the search bar at the top, but our Facebook page is, of course, Facebook at Patriot Ladies. And I wanted to talk a minute about the Lady Patriot Space website. I've got it up and going. I'm embarrassed to say I actually deleted the entire website in my server. I was cleaning out some other websites the other day, and I got it caught up in them, and I deleted it. So I've actually had to rebuild it. But I will be releasing information on Facebook and on Lady Patriots in a few days or a day or so. I asked him if he would help me with doing some of the admin work, and he graciously said he would, and I appreciate that, Tim. But it's going to be new, improved. Everything has changed. Register, all you have to do is just go in. You can register and go straight in. There's no approval or anything anymore. Also, once you're a member, then you can just go in with Facebook, and we have a Facebook Connect, so you can just log in that way. But that's lady-patriots.com, our regular website, and ladypatriotspace.com is our community. And we want to build a community of great writers, publishers, readers, talkers, thinkers, warriors, and everybody who cares about America. So that's how you find us.
All right. And again, thank you very much. I appreciate, as always, you coming on with us today, Sharon. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Sharon Schutz, Lady
thank
Patriot,
you.
And can't help but have a great level of appreciation. God bless, and hopefully you'll be on again soon.
All right. God bless. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. All right. That's where we're going to end a little bit of the minute of the show. I've intentionally waited till we were in the closing minutes to address the Ferguson, Missouri situation, because it's too early to go in depth. The reason it's too early to go in depth about it is because we still have very few facts about what actually happened. What we have to make sure is that we don't rush to judgment. We've seen it before. We've had it happen before. We saw it. Everybody wants to get angry. Everybody wants to riot. But I have a few simple points that I wanted to point out. Number one, a rush to judgment serves no one. Now, whether or not this young man stole some cigars at a convenience store or not, it's important to show his state of mind. But if he was giving up and he got shot anyway, there's a problem with our police. If there was a scuffle, like a lot of reports have suggested, where he was going after a weapon and shots were fired inside the car and he was shot as a result of that, then that's on that young man. But justice is never served by looting. And when all the facts are not out, no one should be making blanket statements. This event has been as politicized as Trayvon Martin's shooting was. And there is absolutely no reason a tragedy, and it's always a tragedy when there's a loss of life of a young man, because just because he was a criminal today doesn't mean he couldn't have turned his life around tomorrow. When there's a tragedy like this, politicians should stay out. The insinuations from the people in the community that the looting is taking place from people outside of the community, I can buy that, because it makes sense that you don't want to tear up your own stuff. Somebody else wouldn't care. bottom line here is we need to sit down and have a conversation about where we're being led by the media. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being with us. And as always, remember, don't take my word for it. Definitely don't take their word for it. Always be prepared to put in a little bit of effort if you really want to tap into the truth. Goodbye, everybody.
Heartbreak, but it wasn't